But she wasn't in there. I checked every face. I trawled through the whole hall. I let myself be carried outside on the relentless tide, fought ahead to the exit door. Roscoe was holding tight to the door frame, battling the flow. "She come out?" I said.
"No," she said. "Finley's gone to the end of the corridor. He's waiting there. I'm waiting here."
We stood there with people pouring past us. Then the crowd coming toward us from the gate was suddenly thinning. The whole plane load was just about through. The last stragglers were strolling down. An old woman in a wheelchair was bringing up the rear. She was being pushed along by an airline employee. The guy had to pause and maneuver his way around something lying in the entrance to the baggage hall. It was a burgundy leather carry-on. It was lying on its side. Its extending handle was still pulled out. From 15 feet away, I could read the fancy gold monogram on the front. It read, MBG. Roscoe and I dived back into the baggage claim. In the few minutes I'd been out of there, the place had just about emptied. Not more than a dozen people still in there. Most of them were already hauling their bags off the belt and heading out as we headed in. Within a minute, the hall was deserted. The luggage belt was grinding round, empty. Then it stopped. The hall fell silent. Roscoe and I stood in the sudden quiet and looked at each other. The hall had four walls and a floor and a ceiling. There was an entrance door and an exit door. The carousel snaked in through a hole a yard square and snaked out again through a hole a yard square. Both holes were draped with black rubber curtains cut into slats a few inches wide. Next to the carousel was a cargo door. On our side it was blank, no handle, locked. Roscoe darted back and grabbed Molly Beth's carry-on, opened it up. It held a change of clothes and a toilet bag and a photograph, 8x10 in a brass frame. It was Joe. He looked like me, but a little thinner. A shaved, tanned scalp. A wry, amused smile. The hall was filled with the shriek of a warning siren. It sounded for a moment, and then the luggage belt graunched back into motion. We stared at it, stared at the shrouded hole it was coming through. The rubber curtains bellied. A briefcase came out. Burgundy leather. The straps were slashed through. The case was open. It was empty. It wobbled mechanically around toward us. We stared at it, stared at the cut straps. They had been severed with a sharp blade, severed by somebody in too much of a hurry to click open the catches. I leapt onto the moving carousel, ran back against the belt's lurching motion, and dove like a swimmer headfirst through the rubber slats shrouding the yard-square hole. I landed hard, and the belt started to drag me back out. I scrambled and crawled like a kid on my hands and knees, rolled off and jumped up. I was in a loading bay, deserted. The afternoon blazed outside. There was a stink of kerosene and diesel fuel from the baggage trains hauling in from the planes on the tarmac. All around me were tall piles of forlorn cargo and forgotten suitcases. They were all stacked in three-sided storage bays. The rubber floor was littered with old labels and long barcodes. The place was like a filthy maze. I dodged and skidded about, hopelessly looking for Molly. I ran behind one tall pile after another, into one bay and then the next. I grabbed at the metal racking and heaved myself around the tight corners, glancing around desperately. Nobody there. Nobody anywhere. I ran on, sliding and skidding on the litter. I found her left shoe. It was lying on its side at the entrance to a dark bay. I plunged in. Nothing there. I tried the next bay. Nothing there. I held on to the shelving, breathing hard. I had to organize. I ran to the far end of the corridor, started ducking into each bay in turn, left and right, working my way back as fast as I could in a desperate, breathless zigzag. I found her right shoe, 3 bays from the end. Then I found her blood. At the entry to the next bay, it was pooled on the floor, sticky, spreading. She was slumped at the back of the bay, on her back in the gloom, jammed between 2 towers of crates, just sprawled there on the rubber floor. Blood was pouring out of her. Her gut was torn open. Somebody had jammed a knife in her and ripped it savagely upward under her ribs. But she was alive. One pale hand was fluttering. Her lips were flecked with bright bubbles of blood. Her head was still, but her eyes were roving. I ran to her, cradled her head. She gazed at me, forced her mouth to work. "Got to care.
before Sunday, she whispered. Then she died in my arms. Chapter 21. I studied chemistry in maybe 7 different high schools. Didn't learn much of it, just came away with general impressions. One thing I remember is how you can throw some little extra thing into a glass tube and make everything blow up with a bang. Just some little powder produces a result way bigger than it should. That was how I felt about Molly. I'd never met her before, never even heard of her, but I felt angry, way out of all proportion. I felt worse about her than I felt about Joe. What happened to Joe was in the line of his duty. Joe knew that. He would have accepted that. Joe and I knew about risk and duty right from the moment we first knew about anything at all. But Molly was different. The other thing I remember from the chemistry lab is stuff about pressure. Pressure turns coal into diamonds. Pressure does things. It was doing things to me. I was angry, and I was short of time. In my mind, I was seeing Molly coming out of that jetway, striding out, determined to find Joe's brother and help him, smiling a wide smile of triumph, holding up a briefcase of files she shouldn't have copied, risking a lot for me, for Joe. That image in my mind was building up like massive pressure on some old geological seam. I had to decide how to use that pressure. I had to decide whether it was going to crush me or turn me into a diamond. We were leaning on the front fender of Roscoe's car in the airport short-term lot, stunned and silent. Wednesday afternoon, nearly 3 o'clock. I had hold of Finley's arm. He had wanted to stay inside and get involved. He had said it was his duty. I had screamed at him that we didn't have time. I had dragged him out of the terminal by force. I had marched him straight to the car because I knew what we did in the next few moments was going to make the difference between winning and losing. "We've got to go get Gray's file," I said. "It's the next best thing." Finley shrugged, gave up the struggle. "It's all we got," he said. Roscoe nodded. "Let's go," she said. She and I drove down together in her car. Finley was in front of us all the way. She and I didn't speak a single word, but Finley was talking to himself through the whole trip. He was shouting and cursing. I could see his head jerking back and forth in his car, cursing and shouting and yelling at his windshield. Teal was waiting just inside the station house doors, back against the reception counter, stick clutched in his spotty old hand. He saw the three of us coming in and limped away into the big open squad room, sat down at a desk, the desk nearest to the file room door. We walked past him into the Rosewood office, sat down to wait it out. I pulled Joe's torn printout from my pocket and passed it across the desk. Finley scanned it through. "Not much, is it?" he said. "What does the heading mean? E unum pluribus. That's backwards, right?" I nodded. "Out of one comes many," I said. "I don't get the significance." He shrugged, started reading it through again. I watched him study it. Then there was a loud knock on the office door, and Baker came in. "Teal's on his way out of the building," he said, "talking to Stevenson in the parking lot. You guys need anything?" Finley handed him the torn printout. "Get me a Xerox of this, will you?" he said. Baker stepped out to do it, and Finley drummed his fingers on the desk. "Who are all those initials?" he said. "We only know the dead ones," I said. "Hubble and Molly Beth. Two are college numbers, Princeton and Columbia. Last one is a detective down in New Orleans." "What about Stoller's garage?" he said. "You get a look at that?" "Nothing," I said. "Just a couple of empty air conditioner cartons from last year when he was hauling them to Florida and stealing them." Finley grunted, and Baker came back in, handed me Joe's paper with a copy of it. I kept the original and gave the copy to Finley. "Teal's gone," Baker said. We hustled out of the office, caught a glimpse of the white Cadillac easing out of the lot, pushed open the file room door. Margrave was a tiny town in the middle of nowhere,
but Gray had spent 25 years filling that file room with paper. There was more paper in there than I'd seen in a long time. All four walls had floor-to-ceiling cabinets with doors in crisp white enamel. We pulled open all the doors. Each cabinet was full of rows of files. There must have been 1,000 letter-sized boxes in there. Fiberboard boxes, labels on the spines, little plastic loops under the labels so you could pull the boxes out when you needed them. Left of the door, top shelf, was the A section. Right at the door, low down, the last Z. The K section was on the wall facing the door, left of center, eye level. We found a box labeled Kleiner, right between three boxes labeled Clan and one labeled Klipspringer versus State of Georgia. I put my finger in the little loop, pulled the box out. It was heavy. I handed it to Finley. We ran back to the Rosewood office, laid the box on the Rosewood desk, opened it up. It was full of old, yellowing paper. But it was the wrong paper. It had nothing to do with Kleiner, nothing at all. It was a 3-inch pile of ancient police department memos, operational stuff, stuff that should have been junk decades ago. A slice of history. Procedures to be followed if the Soviet Union aimed a missile at Atlanta. Procedures to be followed if a black man wanted to ride in the front of the bus. A mass of stuff. But none of the headings began with the letter K. Not one word concerned Kleiner. I gazed at the 3-inch pile and felt the pressure build up.
"Somebody beat us to it," Roscoe said. "They took out the Kleiner stuff and substituted this junk instead."
Finley nodded, but I shook my head. "No," I said. "Doesn't make any sense. They'd have pulled the whole box and just thrown it in the trash." Now, Gray did this himself. He needed to hide the stuff, but he couldn't bring himself to spoil his sequence in the file room. So he took the contents out of the box and put in this old stuff instead. Kept everything neat and tidy. You said he was a meticulous guy, right? Roscoe shrugged.
"Gray hit it?" she said. "Well, he could have done. He hid his gun in my desk. He didn't mind hiding things."
I looked at her. Something she had said was ringing a warning bell. "When did he give you the gun?" I asked her.
"After Christmas," she said. "Not long before he died."
"There's something wrong with that," I said. "The guy was a detective with 25 years in the job, right? A good detective. A senior, respected guy. Why would a guy like that feel his choice of off-duty weapon should have to be a secret?" "That wasn't his problem. He gave you the box because it held something needed hiding."
"He was hiding the gun," Roscoe said. "I told you that."
"No," I said. "I don't believe that. The gun was a decoy to make sure you kept the box in a locked drawer. He didn't need to hide the gun. A guy like that could have a nuclear warhead for an off-duty weapon if he wanted to. The gun wasn't the big secret. The big secret was something else in the box."
"But there isn't anything else in the box," Roscoe said. "Certainly no files, right?"